Okay, so today is week two of the many. Last week we talked about presence over performance. Today we're going to talk about encounter over entertainment. And again, free English lesson, word nerd. Entertain does not have to mean like something funny or something exciting. The word entertain really just means like the ability to maintain your attention. So you think about, like, you go to an entertaining movie, obviously, it's like, it's sometimes it's funny, sometimes it's dramatic. If you go to people's homes, you know, they call that entertaining. It's like, it's not like you're, like, juggling the entire time, making them laugh, but, like, you're trying to, like, provide them with hors d'oeuvres or, like, conversation or whatever. Like, you're just trying to maintain their attention because, like, what's the worst thing about going to a party, a movie, or a play? You feel bored, like, right? Like, disengaged, you don't have your attention maintained. And so when we think about today, encountering God, rather than like thinking about how we can be entertained, think about that as like, what is maintaining our attention? And I want to start by focusing on the story of the golden calf in Exodus 32, 1 through 6. Again, Moses has brought the people out of Egypt. They freed from slavery through the Red Sea. They've been fed manna from heaven. They've gotten water from a rock, and they find themselves at the base of a mountain. Moses is going up to commune with God. And in chapter 32, verse 1, it says, "When the people saw how long it was taking Moses to come back down the mountain, they gathered around Aaron." Well, it had been 40 days, like, to be fair. It wasn't like an hour, you know. 40 days Moses had been up there. And they said, "Come on, you know, like, make us some gods who can, like, lead us. You know, like, we don't know what happened to Moses. He's been up there for a while. We don't really know what's going on." So Aaron goes, "Okay, so like, give me all the gold you have. Give me your gold and your earrings from your wives and your sons and bring them to me." So verse 3, "All the people took the gold earrings from their ears and brought them to Aaron. Then Aaron took the gold, melted it down, and molded it into the shape of a calf. And when the people saw it, they exclaimed, 'Oh, Israel, these are the gods who brought you out of the land of Egypt.' And Aaron saw how excited they were, so he built an altar in front of the calf. Then he announced, 'Tomorrow will be a festival to the Lord.' And so the people got up early the next morning to sacrifice burnt offerings and peace offerings. And after this, they celebrated with feasting and drinking and indulged in pagan revelry." Wow. Dumb. God had freed them, fed them, and watered them, but they weren't interested in entertaining the idea of waiting on him. They had been freed from slavery, walked through a literal sea, food rains from heaven, water comes out of a rock, and they go, "It's taking too long. Like, what's wrong with you?" It's hard not to be critical of the Israelites at this point, because it's just like, what is, like, literally what's wrong with you? Like, come on. You're like, "Well, it's been 40 days. 40 days since the God of miracles, like, led you out of slavery in Egypt, and now you're upset because you have to wait a little longer?" But they wouldn't let themselves entertain the idea of waiting on God. They chose a God they could see over the invisible and divine God. And we see this pattern kind of continue, because if we look in 1 Samuel 8, 4 through 8, this is after Israel has come into the promised land. They've established themselves as a kingdom. They're being led by the prophets. And it says in verse 4, "Finally, all the elders of Israel met at Ramah to discuss this matter with Samuel. 'Look,' they told him, 'you are old, and your sons aren't like quite as good as you are. So please give us a king to judge us like all the other nations have.'" Do you hear, like, we don't like this whole like prophet thing. Like, those guys have a king. I want a king. Those guys have a guy that we can just go. Like, I know this whole like communing with God thing and like coming to the temple and like leaving sacrifices is great and everything, but like, I just want like a dude who can do that for me, and then I can just go to him and tell him my complaints. Or we can just have like this guy I look to. There's something about like wanting this, like, I want to see and touch. It makes me feel good, right? I want to be able to see and touch what I'm worshiping. So they chose to entertain their flesh instead, through idol worship, through drunkenness, through pagan revelry. There's something about like being able to see and feel. Have you guys ever seen the marshmallow experiment? They showed us when we were training to be a teacher or whatever, and it's like they take these toddlers and they lock them in an interrogation room. Like one at a time, and there's like a little table. The toddler sits at the table, and they put a marshmallow on the table. And there's like a two-way mirror so that the people can watch them. And they go, "Okay, I'm going to give you this big marshmallow. I'm going to put it on the table, but you can't eat it yet. I'm going to leave. And in 10 minutes, I'm going to come back. And if you haven't eaten it, I'll give you another marshmallow. And then they like back out of the room and leave this toddler locked in the room for 10 minutes. And it's so funny watching these toddlers. So like one of them's just kind of like, where am I? Like, what am I doing? Another one like picks it up and like rubs it all over their face. Like is rubbing their body with it. Like, oh yes, the marshmallow. Another little girl like looks at it and like just starts crying. Like she can't stand the pressure of waiting. Another little boy, he like puts it in his mouth, but then takes it back out. And he's like, put it, like, and it's just like, they have no idea what 10 minutes means. Like the idea of 10 minutes is like forever. Hezekiah, my son, has like this little clock in his room. It turns green when it turns 7 a.m. That means he can come out of his room, right? And so it's just to help Bree and I keep our sanity and not wake us up, you know? And so I was in my office one morning working, and he came out of the room, and I heard him, and I go around the corner. I'm like, what are you doing, buddy? He's like, I just want to get up now. It was like 6:55. He had like 5 minutes. And so I was like, dude, and he has like this little chart, like if he sleeps through the night, he gets an X, and every so many X's, he gets like a Hot Wheel, just, you know, bribery. And so I'm like, buddy, you only have 5 more minutes. If you go back in your room right now for 5 minutes, you get an X. And then you get closer and closer to a Hot Wheel. And goes, I don't want a Hot Wheel. Like, I don't want what's later. I want what feels good right now, right? And it, like trying to explain to a toddler how long 5 minutes is like, okay, you know, like Bluey, it's like a third of that. Like, I mean, just it's not long at all, dude. Like, but there's something about like knowing, right? And seeing and feeling that just makes us, I mean, it's certainty, right? It's control. It's security. And so we see a similar story in Genesis 25. I won't read the whole thing verbatim, but it's the story of Jacob and Esau, right? Jacob is the second born. Esau is the firstborn. So Esau is the one who has the right to the birthright. That means he gets a double portion of his father's inheritance. That means he becomes like the priest of the family. And he also is the judge of the family. So any problems that are going on in the extended family, he's the one who gets to say, this is what we're going to do about this. This is the final word, right? Esau, I mean, having a birthright is a big deal. Esau's the big buff swole dude, you know, driving a dually, like going hunting on the weekends. And Jacob is like the nerdy guy listening to Bible Project in his room. They're two very different brothers. And one day, Esau is out hunting. And he comes home and he's like flat exhausted. And he's like, Jacob, like I need something to eat like right now. And Jacob's like, I'll give you some stew for your birthright. And Esau responds, what good is my birthright to me right now? I'm starving. So he gives up his inheritance, his position as judge for the family, and his position as priest for the family because his tummy's a little hungry right now. He's given up all of the things that have been promised to him because he's not willing to wait. The Israelites were not willing to wait at the foot of the mountain. Esau was not willing to wait in order to get a plate of stew, and they both missed out on what God had for them. They give up because they're hungry and impatient. And that impatience led to a loss of privilege. And that impatient comes from this place of like entitlement. Have you ever, like, think about the three places you see people most impatient: airports, Starbucks, and traffic. Like, what is wrong with us as a society? Like, airports need to be studied because there's something wrong with us. Like, the position of like how we treat each other here in this room to the way you would treat those exact same people at the Delta like check-in is ridiculous. Like, Bree and I were on our honeymoon, or we were going to our honeymoon, and it was like, the planes kept getting delayed, and like we were flying Delta out of Houston, which was like a bad idea anyway. But like, we are on the plane. It is 11:30 at night. We have waited for, like, we were on the plane for like 2 hours or something like that, right? And the lady comes up and she's like, "Hey, so this plane's not going to take off. There's something wrong with it. But there's another plane on the other side of the terminal, and it's kind of like first come, first serve." And I was like, first off, stupid. Like, who, what, really? You're just like, and go, and just stands aside. Well, I was first off the plane, but I mean, I was like, I'm getting that seat. But it's like, my dad flew for years, and he would fly like four times a week. He'd fly from Atlanta to Chicago, Chicago to Florida, Florida to home. And it was just like hearing the stories of, like, you've seen meltdowns on YouTube of people losing their mind. Why is it that we lose our mind at airports? It's because there's no, like, tangibility to it. When they're like, the plane is being delayed because it doesn't work right now. Well, like, what do you mean? Like, does it have a flat tire or will the toilet not flush? Like, what do you mean it won't work? Like, what do you mean? Like, we have to know. Like, show me now why it doesn't work. Why can't I leave? And that insecurity of not knowing creates so much anxiety in us that we're like, no, I need to have control. I need to know when I'm leaving. I need to know when I'm going. Starbucks. I go to Starbucks during the week to work in the mornings, like during the rush, and I'll sit there working on my little laptop and watch people come in. And like a lot of people do like mobile orders, so their orders are just waiting there. And you can tell the people who walk in and they're like, do you have Jennifer? Where's Jennifer? No, I had a double frat mocha. I had a double frat mocha and a sandwich. Is this one's mine? No. I wanted it hot, not cold. I wanted it hot, though. And I'm like, lady, chill out. It's like, and so then it's like, they have to remake it. And she's just, I'm like, is somebody like literally dying right now? Is that why you're in such a rush to get out of here? Because you seem like something really critical is happening. But it's because we can't, like, when we don't have control of knowing like what's gonna happen, it's the sense of like, oh, well, how long do I have to wait? Moses is like, I'm going up to the mountain. I need you guys to chill here. And they're like, yeah, but like how long? And he's like, I don't know, until God is like done doing his thing. And they're like, I don't like that. You pray to God and you're like, God, when is this situation gonna be over with? And he's like, when I'm through refining you through it. And you're like, that's a long time though. And you're like, he's like, uh-huh. Like, I don't like that. Don't you know I have a connecting flight? Get out of my way. Like, I have to get to work. Like, traffic is another one. It's like, I have to get to work, as if like everybody else doesn't have to get to work. It's like, we're like, oh, my schedule. Everyone's like, my schedule. It's like, gosh, so selfish. There's something about like closing your car door that like turns on this portal of like apathy towards the world. You're like, I don't care. I need to get over four lanes with no turn signal. Good luck, everybody else. Like, but we don't like being told to like wait, to hope, to pray, because that like takes time and there's no like tangible end date, right? That's tough. But when it comes to coming into his temple, what do we feel entitled to, right? Because we deserve nothing. And the reality is we're not supposed to come to the temple going, God, gimme, gimme. We come to the temple going, God, you've got me. Use me. I'm your vessel. We come to the temple with an offering. We don't come to the temple going, what do I get this week, Lord? What do you got for me? What feelings are you going to bring up in my heart? What way are you going to make me feel this week, Lord? No, we come, Lord, man, this is the only place I need to be. You're my one thing. I'm coming to you. You've got me. Take me. Have you ever watched Parks and Rec? With Donna and Tom, like the treat yourself days, you know? If you're not, I'm so sorry, I'm about to alienate part of the audience, but there's these two characters, Donna and Tom, and they have what's called a treat yourself day. And that day is just, you say yes to everything. So they take a day off work and they go to the mall and they're like, man, I really like this fur coat, but it's kind of expensive. And they're like, treat yourself. And you're like, you're right. And then they get it anyway. And so they like get their nails done, they eat whatever they want, they buy all these expensive clothes because they're like, I deserve this. And every time I hear somebody say that, I throw up in my mouth just a little bit, like just a little bit, because like the idea that you deserve anything is kind of like, ugh. But they, and that's the thing. It's funny, obviously, it's a show. And they're like, oh, I deserve this. I'm gonna treat myself. And there's nothing wrong with having nice things or getting nice things. But like most things that involve our walk with the Lord, what's more important is the position of your heart with these things. Drinking is not wrong, but justifying your drunkenness because Jesus turned water into wine is wrong, right? Drinking's not wrong, but you laid out on the porch after 16 Natty Lights going, Jesus turned water into wine. Don't think that's what he intended. Citing Matthew 7:1, don't judge others so that you won't be judged after having an affair. Not what God intended. Like, you're just judging me. You're like, yeah, a little bit. Like, stop being so bad. Stop doing bad stuff. Philippians 4:13, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, says the robber as he pulls his mask on walking into the bank. Wrong heart. Wrong heart. The position of our heart is essential to the way that we are with the Lord. And the Israelites were doing the exact same thing at the base of that mountain. They came to Aaron and they're like, Aaron, we just want somebody to lead us. Like, poor little us. Please, can we have a statue to look at so that we can be led? Like, we just want to worship the Lord. And so what does he do? He builds this calf. It even says the next morning, they brought offerings. Like, they went through the motions. And then what did they do? Party, drink, pagan revelry, which you can look up the Hebrew translation. It's fairly graphic. Like, they didn't want to be led. They wanted to feed their flesh. They wanted to feel good. I'm tired of waiting. Because think about when you're getting impatient. Think about being tempted. Think about like, okay, here's a good example. Like when you're dieting. The longer you go between meals, the easier it is to be like, man, McDonald's actually sounds pretty good right now. The longer you go without being able to like eat something to fill your stomach, the more likely you are to like flounder on that promise, right? You're like, I'm not gonna drink soda for 6 months. And then it's like 5 months in and you're like, I will literally kill that dude for Dr. Pepper. When you have to wait, you have to ensure that you're still like plugged in with the Lord, because otherwise you're allowing your flesh to overtake you. And that's what we see with the Israelites is like, as they come out of Egypt, they're freed from slavery, they go through the Red Sea, they're fed with manna, they get water from the rock, they're sitting at the base of the mountain, and we can see evidence of this all along the journey of Exodus as they're whining over and over and over and over again, because all they're waiting for is the next hit, the next miracle, the next mountaintop experience. And then after that, they're kind of like, okay, but like what next now? Like what next? Sometimes I'll get Hezzy, I'll go to the grocery store and I'll bring him like a Hot Wheel, because they're like a buck at Kroger. And so like I'll bring him a Hot Wheel, or typically, and more so this is what happens, I'll bring him like a candy or something. And I go, hey buddy, I've got something for you. And he goes, what is it? What is it? And I'm like, look, a lollipop. And he goes, oh, it's not a toy? And I'm like, excuse me? I'm like, boy, if you don't, you'll never get anything ever again. Like, you know, it's like, but that's like the attitude of the Israelites. God's like, look, water from a rock. And they're like, couldn't have been wine. Like, really? Manna from heaven? Kind of bland. It's like the entire time they're being provided for, they're still going, it's not really what I wanted. It's not really what was going to please me. It's not really what's making my flesh feel good right now. But we see their desire was not to be led. It was to feel good, to be entertained, to have control over something, their own pleasure. But have we traded communion with the Lord for a golden calf? We traded our birthright for a plate of stew. We traded worship for entertainment. We have this when we have this entitlement to control every little itch and want to scratch every little itch, we rob ourselves of our birthright because we get confused as to what the point of this is. Many of you, I can tell by the color of your hair, were probably around during the Jesus movement of the 1970s. It's either the color of your hair or the sheen off that head, either one. But I was looking up the Jesus movement this week, and it was really interesting. Obviously, like, it's kind of difficult to gather solid data about such like a widespread cultural experience, but it's estimated that the largest number of baptisms ever recorded in a single year was 445,725 people in 1972, the height of the Jesus movement. And of those people, 137,667 were between the ages of 12 and 17. Probably some of y'all, right? No laugh that time? Okay. I'll move on. The point is, people like Billy Graham had this massive impact on culture. Massive. Like, Billy Graham is like a titan of Christianity, right? God bless him. God rest his soul. Like, a titan of Christianity who changed the culture of the West. Like, completely changed the way that people saw Jesus. He introduced an entire generation of people to Jesus, right? And I don't want, please, for the rest of this message, please do not hear me like downplaying what Billy Graham did, but I want to say that I think that we're moving into a new season. Because I'm afraid if we keep living off the hype of the Jesus movement from the 70s, is that we're simply equipping babies for the battlefield and giving them no path to grow. Revelation 5, 9 through 10 inspired that song we sang, that last song we sang. You are worthy to take the scroll and to break the seal and to open it. For you were slaughtered, and your blood has ransomed people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. And you have caused them to become a kingdom of priests for our God, and they will reign on the earth. We were called to be a kingdom of priests. But we can't just hand people a robe and a staff and say, go be priests now. Here you go. You're a priest now. They're like, well, what do I do, though? Like, what am I supposed to do with this stick? What am I supposed to do with this robe? What am I supposed to do with this whole priesthood thing, right? We have an obligation to people who enter into the kingdom to then teach them how to be priests. All of us in this room are priests. We are a kingdom of priests. And just by pulling somebody over the line and being like, you're saved. Good luck with the rest of your life. We do them a disservice. We do them a disservice. We get a bunch of Matthew 4s. Matthew 4, 3 through 5 says, listen, a farmer went out to plant some seeds. As he scattered it across the field, some of the seeds fell on a footpath and the birds came and ate it. Other seeds fell on shallow soil with underlying rock. The seeds sprouted quickly, but the soil was shallow. So the plant soon wilted under the hot sun, and since it didn't have deep roots, it died. Rocky soil converts burn up, but then they stick around. I planted okra last year, and I don't know if any of you have ever planted okra. It gets like taller than I am. Had so much okra. And then when it dies, it's not like a wimpy little plant that just kind of falls over into the ground. It's just like a giant stalk. It just stays there. It's almost like a piece of bamboo. It's like hollow and stiff. And so it was like, it just stayed there for months. I just left it there. And when we have these rocky soil converts who come into the kingdom, who don't get taught how to read their Bible, how to pray, how to exist in Christian community, how to handle conflict, how to do this whole Jesus thing, they become these rocky soil converts that shoot up with excitement, and then they die, but then they stick around. That's why you have people in church who are the exact same way they were 30 years ago when they became saved. And that's not a shame thing. I think that's a sad thing. I think that we've missed the mark there. And it can come from a place of learned helplessness. Like we see in 1 Corinthians 3, 1 through 3. Dear brothers and sisters, when I was with you, I could talk to you. I couldn't talk to you as I would spiritual people. I had to talk to you as though you belonged to this world or as though you were infants in Christ. I had to feed you with milk, not solid food, because you weren't ready for anything stronger. And you still aren't ready. For you are still controlled by your sinful nature. You are jealous of one another and quarrel with one another. Doesn't that prove that you're controlled by your sinful nature? Aren't you living like people of the world? How'd you like to receive that letter? You're like, oh man, Paul wrote us again. Oh, he's mad. Like, but it's like this Israelite, like, learned helplessness of like, feed me, water me, change me. Do it for me. Trying not to be offensive, but I'm about to be offensive. The thing is, it wasn't like what Billy Graham did, and I'm citing Billy Graham as like one of like tens of people who you could cite, but like the Jesus movement was incredible, but we can't live off the hype of the Jesus movement until, you know, the next coming, right? I think Billy Graham laid the foundation for what people are now meant to build upon, which is discipleship. Billy Graham like introduced people to Jesus, but I want to let people get to know Jesus. I want to teach people how to get to know Jesus. I've met many of my heroes in life. Dallas Taylor, lead singer of Maylene and the Sons of Disaster, probably like super niche like reference. Nobody gets that except for maybe Truby. He's like in a screamo band that I loved in high school. He played a concert one time that my friend went to. They met him backstage, shook hands. Months later, my friend and I, the same one, go to Atlanta to see Maylene and the Sons of Disaster play. And in between shows, we walked up the staircase and Dallas Taylor, the lead singer, was coming down the staircase. And we were like, oh, and I was like, he's shorter than I thought he was. That's crazy. But he shook our hands and he stopped and he like introduced himself. I was like, hey guys, how are you? It's so nice to meet you and everything. And my friend Hunter said, hey, I know you don't remember me, but like we met. And he goes, yeah, we met at Warped Tour about 2 months ago. And he goes, like, just the sweetest guy in the world, but like on stage, you wouldn't know that. Like, he's headbanging, sweating over everybody, screaming into a microphone, but like, that's who he was. Another one of my heroes I met, again, another musician, of course. There was this lead singer of this band. You wouldn't know them because it was like really tiny, but I thought he was the coolest guy. I was like, man, he's a lead singer of this band. They're so good. Well, like, fast forward years later, he becomes my roommate and we lived together for 3 years. You know, he's like, he's just a dude. Like, you realize it's like these people, you're like, wow, these titans of the world. And then you like meet them and you're like, oh, it's just a person. Like, he's cool. Another one, Luke Cunningham. I know Luke pretty well. And like at one point in my life, I was like, oh, my mentor, Luke, yes, I bow down to you. Teach me all of your ways. And then I learn from him and I spend time with him and I go, he's just a dude. Like, he's just a dude, a wonderful dude. Don't get me wrong, a wonderful dude, but he's still like just a person. And I think sometimes we, in life, we put people on this pedestal, and then when we get to know them, sometimes we realize like, oh, like they're just people. On the opposite side of that spectrum, I think that especially the culture we live in, living in the Bible Belt, you could mention Jesus to anybody in this city, and 99.9% of them would go, I know who you're talking about. And they would have a preconceived notion about him. But the reality is so much greater than what they actually know about him. You see people on stage, and you see musicians, and you see people, and you get to know them, and you're like, oh, like, they're just people. Like, your perception of them comes down a little bit. It's not so glorious. It's not so gilded. It's like, oh, they're just people. With Jesus, it's the exact opposite. It's like, whatever you heard, I promise you it's better. Whatever you've heard, I promise you he does more. Whatever you've heard, I promise you he can do more. Jesus will exceed people's expectations. And so that's what I want to do. It was like Billy Graham took Jesus and had everybody shake his hand, and now it's our job to say, come, get to know him now so that he can change your life. He's more than just a handshake and like, look how cool I am and watch these miracles. He is a personal relationship that we can tap into. He is a part of us, right? Like, we crave being back into the garden, right? That's the whole thing about like why we feel this need to have tangible things we can touch and feel and see. Adam and Eve got to walk with God in the garden, and then they were cast out. And so now we have this, C.S. Lewis calls it like this unknown yearning of somewhere we've never been or whatever. It's like, we know that there's more. And so we try to fill ourselves with like, oh man, if only this like worship experience or this podcast or this boat or whatever, like whatever your thing is, you're trying to be like, this is the thing that's going to make me happy. This is the thing that I'm going to attain that's going to fill me up and make me feel better. And you realize it's like filling up a bucket with a hole in the bottom. It just flows out. It just flows out. Ask anybody in here who's ever like fulfilled that. It's like, yeah, you're like, I mean, it kind of is just, You know, even like thinking about Thanksgiving dinner. I love Thanksgiving. I love Thanksgiving. I want to go and just eat and eat and eat. And then afterwards, you're like, I mean, it was all right. Like, even the best one, you're like, I mean, it was all right, you know? But when you yearn for Jesus, when you yearn for the Lord, it's just like, that's the only thing that satisfies. When I get into his presence, it's like, man, I don't care. I don't care about these things I have, these things I don't have. Lord, I just want you. Fill me, Lord. Fill me. This is what I want. Matthew 12, 38 through 40, it says, one day, some teachers of religious law and Pharisees came to Jesus and said, teacher, we want you to show us some miraculous signs to prove your authority. And Jesus replied, only an evil, adulterous generation would demand a miraculous sign. But the only sign I will give them is the sign of Jonah. For as Jonah was in the belly of the great fish for 3 days and three nights, so the Son of Man will be in the heart of the earth for 3 days and three nights. It's funny, it's kind of like convicting a little bit because you're like, Jesus says only an evil generation will demand signs and wonders. And then I think about Gideon demanding God like show him the fleece, right? Like, is it wet, is it not wet? And kind of thing. And I go, well, hold on, like why, what's going on? I think Jesus knew the heart of the Pharisees, because the reality is the Pharisees had already seen Jesus perform signs and wonders. They had heard testimonies from hundreds of people about his signs and wonders. What Jesus is realizing is like, you don't actually want a sign and wonder. Because no matter what I do, you're gonna twist it. He's like, I already performed some and you said that I was of the devil, that I was doing work for Satan. He's like, you have an insatiable appetite for miracles. Because what you're looking to do is you're looking to trap me. You're just looking for one thing, some sort of evidence to speak against me. Jesus knew that it wasn't the sign and wonders that they were concerned about. It didn't matter how many miracles he performed. It didn't matter how many things he did for them. The Pharisees would find something to be critical of. It's coming to church and going, I mean, it was all right, but like they didn't sing any hymns. So it's kind of like, meh. I mean, like their worship was good, but like their pastor's kind of mid. It's like, you know. It's like, I don't like the lights. I don't like the lights. The lights are just, I just don't like it. I don't like the way the seats are turned like this. I want to sit like this, but I don't want to sit in the middle. But I also don't want to sit in the front. So I just wish their seats were different. And it's like, what are you here for? Why are you here? Because I'll tell you, you're not looking to encounter Jesus. Because I'll tell you right now, like, if I want to encounter Jesus, I will push you over to get to encounter Jesus. I'm not going to be like, not the right environment. Can't worship here. Sorry. Like, I'll push my wife to worship Jesus, okay? Like, if you're, like, looking to get in touch with Jesus, like, people shouldn't be getting in your way, right? If your heart is not positioned to encounter God, then your heart's going to be critical of how entertained you felt. If you're shopping churches and you're going, well, let's just see how well they perform for me. It's like, you're not going to find what you're looking for regardless. There's no perfect church anyway. I've told people before, recently, they're like, I'm like, there's things about our church I don't like. Like, nobody's perfect. I'm not looking to create a perfect church for people to come feel in a perfect way. I'm trying to create a space where people can come and encounter God. This is a temple to come worship the Spirit in, okay? This is not to scratch any itch you got. I love you. But like, if you're coming in here with the wrong heart, I want to help you with that. But I'm not gonna coddle it. At the same time, church should not be boring. I remember thinking church was boring when I was growing up, going like once a year to Easter or whatever. But at the same time, the pastor had like a kid's time at the altar. So like all the kids got to come down and like we would get something. And in my mind, I'm kind of like, I feel like that's breeding a bad thing in the future, like expecting something to get that I can take home. I don't know. Anyway, God bless Pastor Sheets. He baptized me when I was a baby. I'm sure it's wonderful. Anyway, I don't think church should be boring. Our worship is top notch. Our visuals are top notch. Our sound, top notch. Social media, top-notch. Preaching, adequate. But like, we have a church that probably looks a lot different, I would say specifically from other churches in town. We have extremely talented people on our worship team. We have extremely talented people back there behind that soundboard doing cameras. Extremely talented people. And those are great things about being here, but they should not be the reason that you are here. I love Upper Room worship. Love Upper Room. I'm trying to think, what are their songs? Jan, you can clip me twice because I'll sing again this week. You saved me, the enough, you know. What's another one? Oh, the one we just sang, Is He Worthy? None Like You, like all, they're like my anthems. Like if you see me driving down the road, I'm either listening to a really nerdy, like spiritual theological book, or I'm screaming Upper Room. And you can tell by how loud it is. Like Upper Room goes all the way up. But the thing is, I don't need Upper Room to worship. I don't wait going, oh man, I'm just waiting for that next Upper Room song so I can enter back into worship again, so I can just find that feeling again. The desire for worship is already in me. I crave worshiping my God. And it's the overwhelming desire to worship him that brings me to worship, right? I don't listen to worship music so I can worship. I want to worship so I listen to worship music, right? Okay? If I don't have Wi-Fi, I sing poorly, but I'm singing, okay? I don't need the Wi-Fi. I don't need the big band and the production and the music and the lights and the sound system. My heart yearns for it. In Luke 19, 39 through 40, it says, but some of the Pharisees among the crowd said, teacher, rebuke your followers for saying these things. People are around Jesus welcoming in like, hail, 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 praise him, praise him. And the Pharisees are like, tell them to stop doing that. And Jesus is like, if I tell them to stop, the rocks themselves are going to cry out in worship. He's like, I can tell them to shut up. The ground is going to start shaking with worship. You know why? Because creation hasn't forgotten who God is. There has been no separation. There has been no fall with creation except for us. We have this longing in our hearts to go, I'm just searching, I'm wandering, I'm looking to find. And Jesus is like, the rocks will cry out in worship for me. The rocks will cry out in worship. But sometimes we lose sight of it, right? And that, again, that's that product of the fall. It's like we were with God in the garden. We were walking with him. We had that intimacy. We could see him. He's right there in front of us. And we've cast out, and there's that part of us that still exists that we're like, where are you? We want you. We crave you. And like, we'll do things. We'll look for great worship experiences, or we'll hang crosses everywhere, or we'll seek out like church pastors who like really pump us up or whatever. And like, those are all good things. Those are all good things. Don't hear me wrong. But like, but if that's the thing, we've got it backwards. I want to know my God more, so I seek out great pastors who teach me about my Lord, right? I want to worship, so I want to seek out good quality worship, so that I worship with great quality. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. But if we're going, that worship didn't really please me, you're coming to the temple with the wrong attitude. You've come without an offering. If you're coming to the temple saying, oh, what do we have here? You're plucking things off the altar yourself, going, I'll take that goat back home for me. Yes, this is serving me very well. No, 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 no. Uh-uh. You come offering yourself to the altar. Lord, you may have me. Take me. Right now, in 1 Corinthians 3:12, it says, now we see things imperfectly, like puzzling reflections in a mirror. Or I like the more poetic verse from whatever translation is, through a mirror darkly. But then we will see everything with perfect clarity. I think we have that longing. That longing is such evidence to me of creation, of like knowing that nothing in this world satisfies. Like, again, you could fill yourself on drink, wine, women, money, whatever it is. It will never satisfy you, ever, ever. You can indulge yourself. Think about all the famous people who we see, like Elvis, Bob Marley. I'm trying to think, oh, there's tons. Jim Morrison. I'm trying to think of all these people who have gained fame and wealth and everything they wanted, end up ending their lives. Why? Because it seems purposeless to them. When they just have endless access to these things and they have, there's no boundary for them to stop, yet they're not happy. Huh, I wonder what that tells you. Maybe these things don't bring satisfaction. Maybe it doesn't fill that longing in their heart, because even if they were unbelievers, that longing still exists from them. There's still evidence of creation written on their soul. And so they have this longing of being back in the garden, being back in the presence with God. We have that same thing. And I know that sometimes, man, like life is exhausting. Sometimes it's like we come in the door sweaty from hunting. And we're like, man, I just want that plate of stew right now. Man, I just need to feel different right now. I just need to feel something better. But when we take that stew, in that moment of fleshly weakness, in that moment of impatientness, in that moment of hunger, when we accept that stew, we trade our birthright, right? When we accept the golden calf over the Ten Commandments, like, we give up this thing that God has meant for us, for something that moth and rust will destroy, that will bring zero satisfaction to us. Like, we have to be conscious of our flesh desiring these things that are going to bring us pleasure. And we have to remember, like, we were made to be a kingdom of priests. God did not create us to be a kingdom of babies walking around with robes and sticks. We can't allow ourselves to continue to be infants feeding off of milk. Paul tells you pretty straight back in Corinthians. He's like, I couldn't even talk to you guys the right way because you're still babies. You're still living out of your flesh. I'm like, I don't know about you. That's extremely convicting to me. I'm like, dang, what if Paul wrote our church a letter? What is Paul going to say about our church? What is he going to say about the leadership? What is he going to say about the people sitting here? Like, what is he going to say about our church? Is he going to be like, wow, I really love the Spirit. I love that you guys are seeking after the Lord. Or is he going to be like, you guys are on like milk. What are you doing? You have to remember, when we're coming into the temple, we're not coming to seek what's going to bring us entertainment. It's going to bring us satisfaction. We're coming to the temple saying, Lord, have me. You have my life. Lord, these other things that I've sought after, they have brought me shame. They've brought me frustration. They've brought me to dead ends. They've brought me nothing worth living for. And Lord, so what I'm saying is, like, you may have my life. Do with me as you will. And I promise you, I can tell you from experience, like, giving yourself up is the most satisfying thing in the world. It's like making yourself an offering is the most satisfying thing in the world. You talk about, like, having peace. I talk to a lot of teenagers. and a lot of like college age kids who are like, man, I just am not at peace. I'm not at peace. And then they tell me about what they're doing, and it's like their life is full of striving. God bless you, like well-intentioned, but like it's full of striving. I have to study harder. I have to work harder. I have to pray harder. I have to read longer. I have to please my parents, and I have to do this and do that. I got to think about getting married. It's like your life is like living on a hamster wheel. You're just spinning, 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 spinning. And although those things still need to happen, the position of your heart should not be, God, yeah, I know you're up there on the mountain doing something good for me, but right now I need this calf. God, I know that I have a birthright waiting for me, but right now I need this stew. Have that patience to wait and say, Lord, you know, right now this is what I feel. This is what I think I want, but I'm also willing to wait on you, Father. I'm willing to wait on you. I'm not coming here to be entertained. I'm coming to encounter you.